It is Tuesday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, polls show the presidential race is tightening. We look at how the state of Florida figures in the contest.
It's not only that we're an old state, it's that older voters vote at a much higher rate than younger voters.
Turkish journalists feel increasing pressure, and Dutch DJ Martin Garrix gains popularity through electronic dance music. It's all ahead. Polls are showing the presidential race between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump are tightening. A recent ABC News Washington Post poll shows Clinton with a one-point lead over Trump, while another poll by the Los Angeles Times shows Trump with a 3.6 advantage. The Clinton campaign has struggled during the past week with the reopening of an investigation into Clinton's emails. And late last month, the Obama administration announced premiums for health care plans sold through a government marketplace would rise by 25%. Clinton has run as a firm backer of the program. A key state in the election is Florida. Clinton is campaigning there today. I spoke to Daniel Smith, professor of political science at the University of Florida. Speaking from Gainesville, he tells me how the election is proceeding so far in the state.
Well, there are millions of Floridians who have already cast their ballots. And I know that may sound strange to some of your listeners, but Florida has a very permissive vote-by-mail program. And so we've had well over 2 million people who have cast a ballot just by voting through the mail. And we also have a very robust system of what we call early in-person voting here in Florida. And that is also going like gangbusters, where we have had close to 2 million votes cast already by people coming to a polling place near where they live and casting a ballot.
Certainly, there's several factors involving Florida. One, it has a large Latino community. There's also a fairly large senior citizen community. How could this play in the election?
Sure. When you take a look at Florida's demographics, we do skew older. But what is really the hallmark of Florida voting is that older voters tend to turn out disproportionately more than their younger compatriots who are registered to vote. So it's not only that we're an old state, it's that older voters vote at a much higher rate than younger voters. And so it disproportionately skews the electorate to an older and as well as a whiter electorate. That said, we now have about 17% of our registered voters are Hispanic, about 13.5% are African American. And what we're seeing so far is that Hispanic voters are turning out to vote at a rate that is much higher than they did in 2012. African Americans, not so much. And that's going to be the real key for who's going to win the presidency in terms of Florida, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, in terms of the next week of early voting, absentee ballots coming in, as well as, of course, on Election Day on November 8th.
Now, I had heard that Hillary Clinton had a larger amount of offices for her campaign in the state, apparently, than Trump did, even though Trump does have property, owns, you know, property in Palm Beach. But do you know, I mean, are there recent figures about how that is shaping up, about the popularity of the two of them?
Right. So Hillary Clinton has had a very strong presence on the ground in terms of not only volunteers but paid staffers. They are going to be crucial in terms of getting people to turn out to vote who haven't already voted early or by mail. And we're talking about another 9 million or so voters who are eligible to vote. We've had over 4 million votes cast. We have about 13.5 million registered voters. So there are a lot of votes to be tracked down and brought home for either of the two candidates. Hillary Clinton does not seem to have the same type of enthusiasm among many of her supporters or just rank-and-file Democrats or no-party affiliates, unlike Donald Trump. The question is, has Donald Trump's supporters already come out to vote and there are less likely to have in reserve coming to Election Day, and whether or not Hillary Clinton is going to be able to get these less excited voters to the polls and cast a vote for her. So those ground troops are going to be very important for the Clinton campaign. that Donald Trump doesn't have them, doesn't seem to be affecting him yet, but it might when push comes to shove towards November 8th.
The last few days, there's been so much controversy in this campaign concerning reopening of a FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton, some emails involving Hillary Clinton. Does that seem to have had any impact yet, say in Florida? Perhaps it's too soon.
Well, the interesting thing is it has absolutely no impact for, at the time, the 3 million or so people who had already cast their ballots. They can't come and change their vote because of the latest revelation, either with Hillary Clinton or with Donald Trump. Those are in the bank, and voters may have some regrets. My sense is that the campaign has already raced so far to the bottom with so much trash being thrown one direction or another that another scandal either way is probably not going to change too many people's minds at this point in the game.
Daniel Smith, professor of political science at the University of Florida. Well, joining me here in the studios is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure there's continuing reaction on social media to this election.
Absolutely. People are still talking about that FBI email investigation and the release of those emails, the announcement from the FBI that they were going to be looking into them. And now in the final week of the campaign, everybody on social media kind of turns into a poll watcher. So you see a lot of trending topics where Donald Trump is up one in this state or Hillary Clinton is up three in this poll. So you see a lot of that back and forth. As we've talked about on the show before when we've had Jim Malone, our political correspondent, on, polls are kind of a snapshot. And so you see a lot of these snapshots on social media and people kind of run with them. But if you look at it all together, it fluctuates back and forth. And I'm sure it will continue to do so until we get to Election Day as people react on social media. But I want to turn to the U.S. heartland, the state of North Dakota, because there's a fascinating social media story going on there. Now, for the past couple weeks, there have been protests in North Dakota over an oil pipeline that is supposed to come through the Sioux Rock, Standing Rock Sioux, Native American tribe in the U.S., this Dakota Access Pipeline. And the protests there have, like as I said, gone on for weeks. People have come to North Dakota to protest, and they've been subsequently arrested for protesting. And it was revealed that one of the ways the police were tracking the protesters was through Facebook check-ins. People that were there protesting were checking in, saying, I'm here protesting, and that's how they find these people. Well, it started this viral campaign yesterday where people across the country, not just in North Dakota, but all over the country, were checking in at the protest site to confuse police. So you had thousands of people throughout the United States checking in. I saw in my newsfeed several of my friends were checking in there, even though I knew very well they were not in North Dakota. And it's a way for people to kind of join in with this protest against this oil pipeline without actually being in North Dakota and using social media to do so. So a really fascinating way to use social media as a protest tool, and one that I think, as from what I've read, did indeed confuse the police. They were unable to try to track as many people because they had suddenly hundreds of thousands of different check-ins, but certainly not hundreds of thousands of protesters there.
Virtual participation.
Absolutely. Virtual protests.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. Iraqi forces enter the Islamic State-held city of Mosul. An earthquake aftershocks bedevil central Italy. Amnesty International demands Russia immediately release a jailed activist. And the Syrian government and rebel forces could face Aleppo war crimes accusations. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists have found evidence that ancient sailors took advantage of various climate patterns, such as El Niño, to travel to and settle on remote islands of the tropical Pacific Ocean 3,400 years ago. Using computer simulations and climatic data, the researchers found that the mariners who traveled over thousands of kilometers of ocean had to overcome strong currents and hazardous weather to reach the islands. They found that people who settled western Micronesia probably came from the nearby Maluku or Spice Islands. They say that those who made East Polynesia their new home probably came from Samoa, and settlers of Hawaii and New Zealand may have come from the Marquesas or Society Islands. The researchers are still trying to determine what caused the island settlers to leave their original homes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a report on the growing popularity of electronic dance music. The United States Monday expressed renewed concern over the widening crackdown on dissent in Turkey following the abortive coup July 15th. Turkish authorities detained the editor and senior staff of a leading opposition newspaper, Cumhuriyet, over its alleged support of Kurdish separatists and support for the attempted coup. John Kirby is a State Department spokesman.
The United States is deeply concerned by what appears to be an increase in official pressure on opposition media outlets in Turkey. The United States supports the government of Turkey's efforts to bring to justice those responsible for the 15 July coup attempt, of course. We stand by our friend and NATO ally Turkey in the fight against terror in all its forms, including against the PKK. However, as Turkey's ally and friend, we encourage the government of Turkey to ensure that the rule of law and fundamental freedoms are protected. Democracies become stronger by allowing diverse expressions of views, particularly in difficult times. Suppressing speech and opinion and the press does not support the fight against terrorism and only encroaches on the fundamental freedoms that help ensure democracies remain strong.
A Turkish Journalists Association said since the July coup attempt, 170 publications and news outlets have been shut down and hundreds of journalists put out of work. Deputy Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is to deliver a speech Tuesday night to the American-Turkish Council and the U.S.-Turkish Business Council. University of San Francisco regional analyst Stephen Zunas tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, despite Turkey's past repressive military governments, civil society has blossomed alongside Turkey's cultural and religious traditions, and this latest crackdown is a serious development.
No one seriously believes that this decidedly moderate secular newspaper and quite a few other publications and civil servants and others who are also being targeted in this crackdown have ties to terrorists. The government is clearly continuing to use the coup attempt to crack down on any and all dissent, including those that have absolutely no ties with the coup plotters and indeed came out very strongly against the coup.
More than 110,000 people have been sacked or suspended and 37,000 arrested over the past 3.5 months.
It's unbelievable how widespread this crackdown has been, especially since the coup only involved a few thousand people, and most of them were arrested immediately. Turkey has a long tradition of a professional civil service and an independent media. Turkey's population is extremely literate and professional compared to most countries in the Middle East. And to see this kind of crackdown more reminiscent of a third world dictatorships is something that should alarm anyone concerned about basic human rights.
Stephen, to your knowledge, and I know you visited Turkey in the past, does this have wide public support?
The initial crackdown did have widespread support. There was quite a bit of outrage at the coup attempt. But the way that the crackdown has gone way beyond that, in a way it's clearly an attempt for Erdogan and his party to consolidate their rule in a more directly authoritarian fashion, has raised concerns. At the same time, the personal popularity of the government and their increasing monopoly on information has led quite a few Turks, a surprising number, in fact, to support this continued crackdown, and is indicative of a growing polarization between those who back the government and those of the various political tendencies, and especially those of a more democratic orientation who oppose it.
That's University of San Francisco regional analyst Stephen Zunas. Turkey has accused exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen of orchestrating the failed coup and has demanded his extradition from the United States. On Monday, a senior U.S. official told reporters there are reasonable grounds to take Turkey's contention seriously. But he also said Ankara has provided scant evidence to back up its claim. Gulen, who lives in exile in Pennsylvania, has denied any involvement. This is VOA.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people choose a new president. VOA's live election night coverage begins at 2200 hours Universal Time. As events unfold, we'll bring you the finale of this historic campaign from Washington and VOA correspondents across the United States and around the world. Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, you'll hear comprehensive coverage until the last speech is done. It's America Votes 2016 on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Another DJ has found success through electronic dance music. Here to tell us about it is VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London.
Today, we're going to talk about an electronic dance music producer. We've addressed this phenomenon a few times in the past, but today we're going to look at a guy who at 20 was the youngest ever to be named the world's number one DJ. And that's according to DJ Magazine. His name is Martin Garrix, and he is from the Netherlands. And right now he is doing very, very well with his project that's out these days and a new song that he's got recorded on the charts with Bibi Rexha. She's an Albanian singer who is just tearing things up. She's just hot, really, really hot right now. And she's about to release her own solo debut album. But Martin Garrix is the big story, along with the other stories in EDM, like Flume, who we covered recently, and Skrillex, and Diplo, and Major Lazer, and Tiesto. Now, Martin Garrix got his start when he was a teenager. In 2004, he kind of fell in love with the whole phenomenon of creating and mixing music in his own home, which he did on his laptop in his bedroom. And then about 10 years later, he released his very first song, which became a hit. And so here we are now with the new single from Martin Garrix called In the Name of Love.
If I told you this was only gonna hurt, if I warned you that the fire's gonna burn, would you walk in? Would you let first, do it all in the name of love.
Well, yeah, you said he had his first hit when he's 20. How old is he now?
He is 20.
That's, he's still 20.
He's 20 right now. He had his first hit when in about 2014. So that was about 6 years ago, which would make him 14 at the time, because now he's 20. And now he's on the charts with In the Name of Love, which we just heard with Bibi Rexha. And that is already one of Spotify's top downloaded songs in the UK and here in the United States. And it's climbing up the charts very quickly, already a top 20 hit for Martin Garrix. Now, that's a name that you haven't heard much in the past, but you're going to be hearing from in the future. He's from the Netherlands. As I mentioned, he's a very, very popular DJ. He's on tour. He's performing at all the big music festivals. And he was just included in a new EDM-themed documentary, which is called What We Started, which will show the history of EDM and the recent surgence of the style of music called electronic dance music.
So EDM is going really strong.
It continues to go strong. It's just it's an amazing phenomenon that has not been, you know, new to Europe. In Europe, they've had many, many people doing the DJ stuff for years. David Guetta, DJ Sammy. There have been many, many. But here in the United States, Afrojack, Tiesto, all of these people have just come along and remixed music and also created some new music and taken the world by storm. And Martin Garrix is nominated for many music awards at the Teen Choice Awards and the MTV Europe Music Awards. He's nominated in just all the categories for EDM these days.
Wow. Very impressive. Thanks so much, Larry. That's VOA's Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. That is The New Song in the Name of Love, produced by Martin Garrix. And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Susan Markham, Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, wrapped up a five-day visit to Lao PDR in October, during which she met Lao education officials and visited schools to pave the way for the expansion of the U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative to Laos, which President Barack Obama announced during his visit to the country in September. Following a meeting with the Minister of Education and Sports, Sen Juan Lachantabun, and senior education officials in Vientiane on October 4th, Ms. Markham and her delegation traveled to Luang Prabang and Udomche provinces, where she discussed education and learning needs with teachers, administrators, students, and parents. "We are thrilled to have this opportunity to engage with Lao officials, teachers, parents, and students to learn more about education in this beautiful country," Ms. Markham said. "Through the Let Girls Learn initiative, we can find new ways to collaborate and help ensure that adolescent girls and boys get the education they need to be successful." On October 7th, Ms. Markham met representatives of the Lao Women's Union, Lao National Commission for Mothers and Children, the Lao National Commission for the Advancement of Women's Secretariat, and other donors and civil society groups focused on women and development to further understand the needs of girls and women across Laos. The U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative, championed by First Lady Michelle Obama, works to address the range of challenges preventing adolescent girls from attaining a quality education. Let Girls Learn harnesses existing programs and invests in new efforts to improve educational opportunities for girls worldwide. "The United States is proud to work with Laos to help Lao girls develop their full potential for their benefit and for the benefit of their communities and the people of Laos."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.